tomorrow, increasing clouds throughout the day, temperatures 16 to 21. Winds from the south, 5 to 15. Chance of snow tomorrow evening, lows near 7. Friday, mostly cloudy, highs in the low 20s.
They were invisible. They had been kept at home. Our goal was to end them.
It's the 50th anniversary of the law that created special education as we know it. We take stock of where things stand now and look to the future.
For Wednesday, December 3rd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, a look at the Pentagon press corps, now filled with members handpicked by the Trump administration.
I'm concerned that there is so much damage being done by Pete Hegseth.
And the president says he wants Somalis in the U.S. to leave.
I don't want them in our country, I'll be honest with you. Somebody would say, oh, that's not politically correct. I don't care. I don't want them in our country. Their country's no good for a reason. Their country stinks.
We hear from Minnesota, home to the country's largest Somali community.
And the latest in our Here to Help series. First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. The Pentagon's Inspector General concluded that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth could have put U.S. troops in harm's way by sharing information over Signal in March about a pending U.S. airstrike in Yemen. NPR's Deirdre Walsh reports.
A classified IG report delivered to Capitol Hill found that Secretary Hegseth risked potential compromise of information that could have endangered the safety of U.S. personnel on the mission by using the messaging app Signal. That's according to a source briefed on the report who was not authorized to speak publicly. If intercepted by a foreign adversary, it could have led to harm. Hegseth did not agree to an interview with investigators, but submitted written responses. He noted he has the authority to declassify material, but there was no indication he did before he shared it. An unredacted version of the report is expected to be released on Thursday. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News.
And we should note Catherine Marr, the CEO of NPR, chairs the board of the Signal Foundation. Starting tomorrow, a key vaccine advisory panel at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will revisit the timing of a baby's first hepatitis B shot. Its members were handpicked by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and the panel's recommendations affect insurance coverage. From KFF Health News, here's Jackie Fortier.
Since 1991, babies have typically gotten their first hepatitis B shot within hours of birth. It protects them from the incurable virus that can lead to liver cancer. Babies need the shot even if their moms test negative for hepatitis B, says Sean O'Leary. He's an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Colorado School of Medicine.
Babies can still get it from people in their own household.
Hepatitis B can spread without direct contact through the bodily fluids of infected people. Sharing personal items like toothbrushes can be enough. The CDC panel is expected to vote on new recommendations for the hepatitis B vaccine on Friday.
Jackie Fortier is with our partner KFF Health News. It was deja vu on Capitol Hill today as Jared Isaacman sat for a second Senate hearing. The wealthy private astronaut is again the nominee to lead NASA. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports that Isaacman was about to be confirmed for the post in the spring when President Trump abruptly pulled his nomination.
Jared Isaacman said he wouldn't speculate about why the president renominated him. One senator asked about donations to Trump's super PAC, but Isaacman said it shouldn't be surprising that he supported the Republican Party and that he donated far more to charitable causes. Pressed on his connections to SpaceX and Elon Musk, he said he was independent.
In a world where everybody has a phone with a camera on it, there are no pictures of us at dinner, at a bar, on an airplane, or on a yacht because they don't exist.
He stressed the urgency of returning Americans to the moon before a rival, China, gets there. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
It's NPR. India is rolling back its order for smartphone manufacturers to pre-install a government-run cybersecurity app on new devices. The country initially asked manufacturers to install the app within 90 days and prevent users from disabling it. The directive led to widespread concerns over data privacy. India says the app would help users block and track lost phones and shut down fraudulent connections. As Israeli strikes continue in Gaza, regardless of a ceasefire deal brokered in October, doctors in the Strip say say that they are still struggling to keep up with the needs of the population. NPR's Hadil Alshalchi brings this report.
The Gaza Health Ministry says it will begin the rehabilitation of Al-Shifa Hospital. Al-Shifa, located in Gaza City, used to be the most important medical facility in the territory. The complex itself was the size of 4.5 football fields, but it's now a shell of its former self after 2 years of Israeli bombings. Dr. Nahreen Ahmed traveled from the U.S. to volunteer at Al-Shifa. She says one patient was a 14-year-old girl whose abdomen was shredded due to shrapnel during an Israeli attack earlier this week.
She's currently extremely traumatized from a situation that should have never happened, given that there was a promise of a ceasefire.
Ahmed says Palestinian doctors themselves are exhausted and hungry. Hadil Alshalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
A record 64 nations will be in Friday's World Cup draw as FIFA expands the tournament from 32 to 48 teams. That means there will be 104 games during the international tournament next June and July instead of 64. The final will be at MetLife Stadium in New Jersey. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org.
It's 6 minutes after 5 o'clock. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu at rapidsbrewingco.com. You can answer our question of the week. We want to hear about the things you make to give as gifts. You can text in 218-326-1234.
Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. 50 years ago, just after Thanksgiving 1975, President Gerald Ford signed a landmark law that created special education as we know it. Well, for the next few minutes, we're going to mark its 50th anniversary by taking stock of where things stand today, as the Trump administration has tried to make significant cuts to federal staff who support and protect students with disabilities. NPR education correspondent Corey Turner joins us now. Hi, Corey.
Hey, Elsa.
So can we just first talk about what things were even like for students with disabilities before this landmark law even came down?
In 1970, federal data shows that public schools educated just 1 in 5 children with a disability, Elsa. I spoke with Ed Martin. He's now 94, and he helped write that landmark law that changed that.
Mostly, it was just that they were invisible. They had been kept at home. Our goal was to end that.
So before the law passed, Martin helped organize public hearings for parents so they could share their stories directly with lawmakers.
There was one mother who told us a story about the school bus stopping at the foot of her driveway, and her daughter standing in the window crying, saying, "Why can't I go with the other kids?"
Ultimately, Elsa, Congress listened. They passed what we now know as the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA. Mm-hmm. And the very next school year, it helped some 3.7 million students.
Wow. Okay, and what does it mean that this law helped all of those millions of students? Like, what changed for them precisely?
Yeah, the law guarantees children with disabilities the right to a free, appropriate public education. That means schools have to provide accommodations. They're also required to keep kids in traditional classrooms as much as possible. To help pay for it, Congress sends states billions of dollars every year. And then finally, the Education Department provides oversight through its Office of Special Education Programs, which fields calls from families and it makes sure states follow the law.
And what if parents worry that a school is falling short, or even worse, actually discriminating against their child?
They can file a disability discrimination complaint with the Office for Civil Rights, or OCR. Now, its authority does not come from IDEA, but there tends to be a lot of overlap. And if OCR sees something concerning about how a child has been treated at school, its attorneys can open an investigation, and there's no need for a family to hire an expensive lawyer or advocate.
Well, as we said, we know that the Trump administration has made deep cuts across the Education Department. How might those cuts affect the federal role in special education, you think?
Yeah, in several ways. The Office for Civil Rights lost about half its staff in spring layoffs. And then during the shutdown, the administration fired most of those who were left. They also fired nearly everyone at the Office for Special Education. Now, those shutdown cuts, Elsa, have since been reversed, but there's no guarantee the administration won't try to make them again. President Trump has also said he wants to move special education to a different agency. In defending all of this, Education Secretary Linda McMahon has said she does not want to cut special education funding. Instead, what she wants to cut is, quote, the centralized bureaucracy micromanaging what should be a state-led responsibility, she says.
Well, Corey, you said the Office for Civil Rights now has about half the staff it had in January, right?
Yeah.
What does that mean for parents filing disability discrimination complaints then?
To answer that question, Elsa, I want to introduce you very quickly to one family I met. They live in a Kansas City suburb, Maggie Heilman and her daughter, Brooklyn, who's in eighth grade. Brooklyn has Down syndrome, which also affects her speech. She loves playing basketball, she told me, also dancing. She and her mom talked about how Brooklyn's favorite hot lunch at school is chicken nuggets with mashed potatoes.
Yum.
And I can mow seconds.
You go get seconds? Oh my, I knew you got seconds.
Doesn't it? Get mow my potatoes.
You like to dip the mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
I do too.
Now, in October 2023, Maggie Heilman told me she got a call from Brooklyn School that her daughter had become agitated and was secluded for 20 minutes in a small padded room. Now, schools sometimes turn to seclusion when a student poses a risk to themselves or others. It is allowed in many states, but it can also be traumatic. And Heilman says she told school staff that she opposed the use of seclusion with Brooklyn. After that, she says the school used a kind of informal seclusion.
And we just saw our daughter's health physically, mentally, emotionally deteriorate.
And then finally, Brooklyn switched schools and things immediately turned around for her. But Heilman says she worried for the students who came after her. So she filed a complaint with the Office for Civil Rights, OCR, arguing that Brooklyn had been denied her legal right to a free, appropriate public education.
And what happened with that complaint?
Well, an attorney at OCR opened an investigation, we know that, just over a year ago. But since then, Heilman has had two different OCR attorneys who both appear to have gotten caught up in the administration's mass firings. Heilman hasn't heard anything new about her case in months. In a statement, the department told NPR, quote, we are rebuilding and refocusing OCR to enable the office to protect students and enforce the law. But Elsa, public data suggest OCR is shifting away from these kind of labor-intensive, disability-related investigations. Since Trump took office, it has reached resolution agreements in 73 disability cases. But compare that to the first year of Trump's first term in 2017. Instead of 73, OCR reached agreements in more than 1,000 such cases.
Wow, that's a huge difference. Well, considering how 50 years ago things were really hard for kids with disabilities, how does that compare with where things are now?
I mean, look, IDEA now reaches more than 8 million children, giving them educational opportunities that kids with disabilities simply did not have before this law existed. Yeah. And that is a huge success. Mm-hmm. I think right now we're just in a moment of change, or at least uncertainty. You know, the message from the Trump administration is the money that comes with IDEA should keep flowing to states, but that states can handle the rest without much federal oversight. And frankly, the last time families really had to rely solely on their states was before 1975, when this law was passed.
That is NPR education correspondent Corey Turner. Thank you so much, Corey.
You're welcome, Elsa.
This week, the Pentagon unveiled its new press corps, mostly right-wing outlets handpicked by the Trump administration to cover the Trump administration. You may recall that back in October, established media organizations, including NPR, walked out after refusing to comply with new rules. For an update on who is asking questions at the Pentagon now, I want to bring in Steve Walsh, who covers the military for WHRO in Norfolk. Hey there, Steve.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Let's go back for a sec to the origins of all this. It was a pledge, and the Pentagon wanted all Pentagon reporters to sign it.
Right, right. So the vast majority of outlets from Fox News to the New York Times to NPR refused to sign a pledge that basically said they would not report on anything that was not officially authorized by the Department of Defense, which this administration now calls the Department of War. Shortly after that happened, the Pentagon announced a new group of mainly right-wing outlets, which they say replaces the traditional press corps. These include bloggers and talk show hosts, many of whom have never covered the Defense Department, and many of them were actually asked by the Pentagon to become members of this new press corps. The group that showed up this week included former Congressman Matt Gaetz, who had briefly been President Trump's nominee for Attorney General. He now has a show on the One America News Network, and Laura Loomer, who is a conservative activist with deep ties to the White House.
Now, the Pentagon has not held very many on-camera briefings with reporters, not since Trump took off again back in January. This week, that changed. Tell me more.
Yeah. So starting Monday, they have been getting an orientation. Many of these people don't live in Washington. The media area has been largely vacant since the walkout in October. They posted videos on social media from the Pentagon briefing room, which had been off limits to the press corps for months. Yesterday, Deputy Press Secretary Kingsley Wilson gave her first on-air, on-camera briefing since becoming coming on board in January. Wilson herself has been accused of previously making anti-Semitic posts before she was brought into the Pentagon. She spent a fair amount of time railing against the mainstream media. Now, the questions were a mixed bag. One outlet did ask about when the Pentagon would produce the intelligence to justify the lethal strikes against the boats in the Caribbean. Others adopted the taunt Seditious Six that Secretary Hegseth uses to describe the group of Democratic lawmakers who urged troops not to follow unlawful orders. I spoke with the last deputy Pentagon press secretary under the Biden administration, Sabrina Singh. She worries that this new group is part of a larger politicization of the military.
I'm concerned that there is so much damage being done by Pete Hegseth. There will one day be another Secretary of Defense. Whoever that person is going to have to contend with the fact that we have so deeply politicized service members, and I don't know how you undo that damage.
Well, and just practically speaking, Steve, how is all this changing how you, how other defense reporters are doing their jobs?
Well, I mean, as we know, the lack of access has not stopped the flow of stories coming out of the Pentagon. People are still talking, people are still working their sources, and they're still doing their job. Several outlets did ask for access to the press conference, but they were denied, so it doesn't look like people are going to be getting in the building on a regular basis. We're told the new group met today with Secretary Hegseth, who has only given two on-camera briefings himself at the Pentagon.
And who is very much in the hot seat for all kinds of things right now. WHRO's Indeed. Steve Walsh, thanks very much for your reporting.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
KEXE went on the air in 1976. This year, we lost federal funding like all of public media, but you have come forward. You have told us that KEXE matters. We're grateful for all of you, and especially for the folks that have been here from the beginning, people like Michael Goldberg and Gail Addison.
You know, for me and Gail, it's really been two things, a fabulous music education of all the music that we never imagined or knew anything about, and we're learning still every week. And then the other thing, of course, is that everybody we know through KEXE.
Yeah, we've made a lot of decisions in our life based on having access to this radio station. An extremely rare opportunity to learn a new skill and to share your love of music and to meet so many people through this station as well.
Support KEXE now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
And thank you so much for your support. It is 519. I'm Jennifer Barr. You're listening to All Things Considered. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local stories and conversations at our website, kaxe.org. Support also comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. We also thank the Timber Lake Lodge, hosting a holiday dinner show Tuesday, December 16th, with performances by Greg Kayser, PK Mayo, the Miltich family, and members of the LaPlante family. More information at timberlakelodgehotel.com. Partly cloudy tonight, lows near 10 below. Wind chills will feel as cold as 21 below. 30% chance of snow tomorrow, increasing clouds throughout the day. Temperatures a bit warmer, 16 to 21. Chance of snow tomorrow evening, lows near 7.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Merrily We Roll Along, a new cinematic interpretation of the Stephen Sondheim musical, starring Jonathan Groff, Daniel Radcliffe, and Lindsay Mendez. In movie theaters starting December 5th. And from Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. About 80,000 people of Somali descent now call Minnesota their home. Almost all of them are U.S. citizens. And yesterday, President Trump attacked Somali immigrants in racist and xenophobic terms.
I don't want them in our country, I'll be honest with you, okay? Somebody would say, oh, that's not politically correct. I don't care. I don't want them in our country. Their country is no good for a reason. Their country stinks.
The mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul spoke up to defend their Somali community. They also responded to reports that the Trump administration is targeting that community with extra immigration enforcement. Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio joins us now with more from St. Paul. Hi, Matt.
Hi there.
So what seems to have prompted Trump's statements there?
Well, let me say first that Trump and Minnesota's Governor Tim Walz have been at odds since last year, when the governor was former Vice President Kamala Harris's running mate on the Democratic presidential ticket. At a cabinet meeting yesterday, the president attacked the Somali American community here in response to a question about widespread fraud in Minnesota's social service programs during the Walz administration. And here is some context. Since late 2022, federal prosecutors here have charged 78 people connected to a nonprofit called Feeding Our Future with stealing hundreds of millions of dollars from taxpayer-funded child nutrition programs. The convicted ringleader Amy Bach is white, but the majority of the defendants in this case are of Somali descent, and most are naturalized U.S. citizens. Trump went on to call Somali Americans, quote, garbage, including one of his fiercest critics, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. The Minneapolis Democrat responded, saying, quote, his obsession with me is creepy. And to be clear, neither Walz nor Omar have been implicated in the fraud investigation.
Well, Matt, as we mentioned, there have been several reports that the Trump administration is going to target undocumented Somali immigrants in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. So what have city leaders said about that?
Well, they were quick to respond. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey denounced the president's comments and said that Somali immigrants have been a key part of the community's fabric for decades. Many are not immigrants. They're second-generation Americans who were born here. Frey said that immigration officials are at major risk of violating the community's constitutional rights.
When people are arrested by federal immigration agents, they're going to get the wrong people. They're going to screw it up so badly that they're not just violating habeas corpus, but they are taking away the rights of American citizens.
Mayor Melvin Carter of St. Paul was with Frey yesterday at a news conference and echoed those comments.
Who he just attacked isn't just Somalis. Who he attacked is Somali Americans. Who he attacked is Americans.
And what about leaders in the Somali community? Like, what kind of responses are you hearing from them to all of this?
Jaylani Hussein, who leads the Minnesota chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations and was born in Somalia, came here as a child, said today that the community has reported already seeing an increased presence of immigration and customs enforcement personnel in the Twin Cities. He also said he's received reports of American citizens being asked about their citizenship. Hussein says this is blatantly discriminatory.
Weaponizing ICE to target black Somali immigrants. This is not immigration policy. This is racism being directed from the president's office.
Well, when it comes to local law enforcement, Matt, did police say how they will respond if there is an uptick in immigration enforcement there?
Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara says his department does not enforce federal immigration law, but he did say if there are demonstrations that become violent, police are required to respond to protect public safety.
That is Minnesota Public Radio's Matt Sepik. Thank you so much, Matt.
You're welcome.
And tomorrow on this program, we'll take a look at the Border Patrol's aggressive immigration operation in Charlotte, North Carolina. The week-long operation took the city by surprise, and immigrants and other residents say that their city will never be the same. The economic costs are still rippling throughout the city. Meanwhile, the immigration crackdown caused an outpouring of solidarity among some residents. Hear more tomorrow on All Things Considered.
Immediately after Hurricane Helene flooded western North Carolina in September of last year, neighbors helped neighbors get supplies, operate generators, and reach safety. But many people wanted to do more. As part of our series on volunteerism, here to help, Zachary Turner from member station WFAE brings us this report on western North Carolina's first volunteer emergency response team.
After Helene, Black Mountain resident Chris Kepler sprung into action, using her chainsaw to clear debris.
One of my neighbor's tree fell down across her entire front yard. It blocked her in. She was on oxygen. And of course, we didn't have power or anything. And I wasn't quite sure how I would get hold of first responders because the 911 system was down.
The town's emergency communications had failed, along with their backup radio system. As a former Marine, she felt she could help.
There were a lot of people that wanted to do more, but we weren't trained.
Other residents were in the same boat. They wanted to help, but couldn't. Many had skills that the town could have really used, like Wendy Coins.
As a newly retired family doctor, I felt like there wasn't any organized way for me to help.
So you wanted to help, but
so
you just
I wanted
didn't.
To help, and it was really hard, and we had no set systems in place prior to the disaster for community members just to jump in.
So they decided to start the town's Community Emergency Response Team, or CERT. They spent the last several months training with first responders on disaster communications and preparedness. Now, 28 residents can help with evacuations, traffic control, supply distribution, and other tasks. They got their first assignment during a Halloween event. About 3,000 kids go door-to-door on two blocked-off streets near downtown. It's a big deal in a small mountain community of roughly 9,000. Kepler staffed one of two reunification tents.
We're assisting with lost kids, and so we can communicate between our team and by putting out a description of the child or the parent, if the parent got lost from the child.
Tonight, Kepler and her fellow CERT members get a good lesson on using their new emergency radios. Another volunteer radios Kepler.
What members will be in each group, please?
And Victor 215.
They're trying to use their Victor numbers.
Rover Alpha,
Victor for volunteer.
At the same time I was talking,
instead of names.
Volunteer firefighter David Billstrom has been training the CERT members on the do's and don'ts of using these radios.
So you have to press the button to talk and hesitate for just a minute. The rule is half a second. And then start talking.
Halloween night was a certified success, according to Billstrom. The team reunited four kids with their parents and greatly improved their radio skills. And for Kepler, she feels more prepared.
I always wanted to know, was there more that I could have done? So this gives me the skills to hopefully continue to educate my neighbors, first and foremost, and my family, and make sure that we're ready, and then to be able to help the community at large.
In the meantime, Kepler and the other volunteers will keep training and refining their radio etiquette. For NPR News, I'm Zachary Turner in Black Mountain.
This is NPR News.
It is 529. You're listening to KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And at 7, DJ Lake Poseidon, your volunteer host for On the River. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. The recent discovery of bones in a Chisholm basement is reminding the community of a long-standing unsolved missing child case. An initial investigation Tuesday shows the bones are likely not human. Chisholm police called in the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to assist with the investigation. The bones will be submitted for further analysis to confirm the findings. In a social media update, Chisholm Police Chief James Vukod wrote the department takes every report and potential lead seriously. He pointed to the 2003 disappearance of Leanna Warner. 5-year-old Warner was last seen walking home from a friend's house. Despite a massive search effort, no clear evidence was found. Vukod says the hope is that continued efforts will one day provide answers. Boston city officials are asking the court to step in to force Essentia Health into talks over whether the city has the right to end the healthcare provider's operation of the local hospital. Larissa Donovan has more.
The years-long dispute stems from Essentia Health's decision to end labor and delivery services in Boston and move those services to Detroit Lakes and Fargo. Last year, Boston engaged in a round of arbitration with Essentia Health that hinged on a breach of contract dispute. The city maintained that providing labor and delivery service was an essential part of the agreement. Arbitrators ruled in a split decision that there was no breach of contract, but the decision also stated it, quote, should not be construed as granted Essentia unrestricted freedom to alter core services without consequence in the future. Boston claims that the provider has also cut down on ambulances, removed a long-standing board member, and understaffed facilities. The Boston City Council voted late last year to end its affiliation agreement with Essentia on January 1st. The city further claims Essentia Health is treating the agreement as if it gave Essentia ownership of the nonprofit that owns the hospital, First Care Medical Services. In an emailed statement to KAXE, an Essentia spokesperson disagrees with Boston's assessment and says the provider does own First Care Medical Services and has since the 2009 agreement. Boston has had a vested interest in its hospital for generations and authorized the nonprofit now known as First Care Medical Services as owner of the hospital in 1947.
Obviously, I think it's clear how the vote should go on this property tax increase. At least I hope it's clear.
Zach Van Drunen of Cohasset was one of over 20 people who addressed the Itasca County Board Tuesday night. Counties, cities, and school districts across Minnesota host truth and taxation meetings at the end of each year after proposed property tax statements are sent out. Officials present their proposed budgets, and then community members like Van Drunen can give feedback. Over 100 people attended Itasca County's meeting.
But I want to offer my recommendation. Do it all proper, legal, above board, but let the state know you don't want to play these games anymore. We don't want to do these mandates.
The county board says those mandates are what necessitated its proposed 10% levy increase. After 3 hours of hearing from the public, the board worked the increase down to 7%. They plan to cut more before the levy has to be certified on December 20th. Beltrami County's meeting was also Tuesday. There, commissioners finalized a 9.6% increase, committing to the preliminary budget that cut funding for local libraries by more than 40%. Larissa is back with more.
Beltrami's budget includes a $700,000 contingency account as the county braces for more state and federal cost shifts. The budget also reduces the county's contribution to the Kitchigami Regional Library System, which operates the Bemidji and Black Duck Public Library branches. Bemidji branch manager Sherilyn Warren says hours will be reduced, with the library going from being open 6 days a week to 4. She says people turn more to libraries when times are tough economically and are reducing their own budgets.
Cutting libraries during budgetary crisis is like cutting hospitals during a plague, because that's basically what you're doing, is you're cutting the library at a time when people need it the most.
Around a dozen Beltrami County residents spoke to preserving library funding. According to County Administrator Tom Berry, the county has paid $1.5 million more than it's legally required to over the last 10 years. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, now playing in select theaters everywhere December 5th. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Israel has tested all kinds of new weaponry in the last 2 years of war. This week, it revealed some of that technology and other weapons it has created for future wars. Despite a global outcry over the huge civilian death toll in Gaza, Israel is selling the tech to other countries. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
A lot of the military tech on display this week at an expo at Tel Aviv University looked like something out of a sci-fi movie, like a new high-powered laser that looks like a huge camera lens.
This is the turret from our system called Iron Beam.
Ari Sasher from the Israeli arms manufacturer Rafael. Israel says it will begin to deploy the Iron Beam by the end of the month. The laser can knock rockets, mortars, and cruise missiles out of the sky.
It takes a very powerful beam of light. We heat the target, we deep fry it, and then the target blows up by itself.
When the Gaza war broke out following a Hamas attack 2 years ago, the military began using all kinds of new drones for surveillance and targeting. Daniel Almog's company, Eyes Atop, provides the Israeli military, the IDF, with handheld screens that soldiers use to coordinate multiple kinds of drones.
So that any new drone the IDF wants to introduce, the pilot can fly on day one like a Jedi.
A screen on display shows a recording of a flight over a Palestinian village in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Almog explains what the system can do.
You want to close the kill chain with a single operator. So through our orchestration system, you can call in a kamikaze drone or a strike, heavy lift strike drone like this to drop munition on the target.
Israel also began using unmanned vehicles on the ground in Gaza, Lebanon, and Syria, made by a company called Otopia. They roll into enemy territory, scan and identify targets using AI, and keep the soldier out of harm's way, says founder Amit Rosenzweig.
He or she can drink coffee while using a joystick to control a tank or an APC or whatever it is that he or she needs to control to get the job done.
Palestinians in Gaza have posted videos like this one when a person spots a military robot on wheels.
Yama! That's a robot!
And videos of armored personnel carriers laden with explosives. Again, Rosenzweig.
Some videos were published where you can see something like a large vehicle, APC, that's the purpose of such vehicle is, yes, to go somewhere and explode, not necessarily to take down a building, but maybe take down a bad guy.
Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza, where tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians have been killed, has drawn worldwide criticism, including accusations of genocide, which Israel rejects. Outside the expo, about 30 Israeli university students and faculty protested. Anthropology professor Ofra Goldstein-Gidoni.
The drones, which seems to be very high-tech and great, but basically using AI all this clever technology, many people were killed by drones. And the thing is that we are all complicit here in Israel.
To protest the war, some countries said they would restrict arms sales to Israel. But officials from more than 20 countries attended this Israeli Defense Expo, organizers say. Israeli Colonel Yishai Kohn says defense exports are soaring.
In general, Israel's export has been breaking its record for the past 3 years, each year in a row. And we expect that this year will end with a new record too.
Israel's Aero defense system, which countered Iranian missiles this year, was deployed today in Germany, which sees Russia as a growing threat and sees this tech as essential. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Italian pasta could vanish from the grocery store shelves or at least double in price starting in January. That is if the Commerce Department goes ahead with a decision to slap heavy duties on imports from over a dozen Italian pasta brands. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports on the ongoing negotiations.
Since the 1800s, Italian pasta, fusilli, spaghetti, rigatoni, has been shipped across the Atlantic to be enjoyed by Americans.
Questa non è semplicemente una pasta.
It's not just pasta, says one advert for the Italian La Molisana pasta brand.
È una dichiarazione d'amore, tutta italiana. La Molisana.
It's an all-Italian declaration of love. Under the Trump administration, though, this declaration is being well and truly spurned, and the fight for Italian pasta is now national news. Here's NBC's Today.
Americans could soon be saying arrivederci to their favorite Italian pastas. Imports from 13 Italian pasta brands, including favorites like Barilla and Rumo, are staring down a 107% tariff.
This whopping extra import cost is a combination of tariffs the White House placed on all goods coming from the European Union and a penalty of almost 92% imposed by the U.S. Department of Commerce on pasta brands accused of dumping practices. This is when a company sells goods abroad at a cheaper price than in its domestic market. American competitor pasta producers have long accused Italian pasta brands of doing this, triggering regular investigations by the Department of Commerce. But this time, the penalty is huge, and Italian pasta companies and economic experts don't understand why.
Our update analysis of Italian pasta trade shows no evidence of the pasta dumping behavior.
Chiara Donegani is a senior teaching fellow in economics at Aston University in the United Kingdom. She says Italian pasta trades on the idea of heritage and quality, and so sells at much higher prices than American pasta.
Pasta is an iconic product, the renowned, well-known element of the Mediterranean diet. This is not dumping, this is premium dining, we would say.
The U.S. Department of Commerce says it applied the penalty after two Italian pasta companies it contacted for review, Garofalo and La Molisana, didn't provide the full requested data, and the response included things like untranslated Italian words. The Commerce Department then decided to hit nearly a dozen other Italian pasta companies with the same punitive measures. Why is it doing this? The Department of Commerce didn't respond to NPR's request for comment. Donegani thinks.
Our interpretation is that the short answer is politics and not economics.
President Trump has been using tariffs as an economic weapon for many issues, from trying to bring manufacturing to the United States to applying political pressure on other countries. In Italy, the foreign ministry is now directly involved in the Italian pasta affair, and a special task force has been set up to handle it.
La situazione è quella di una trattativa in corso.
Lorenzo Bazzana from Coldiretti, Italy's trade association that protects Italian produce and food producers, explains negotiations are now underway. And the White House has said Italian pasta brands still have time to engage with a review before the duties are final. If the full duties were imposed, Bazzana says, it would be, of course, bad news for Italian pasta makers, for whom the US is the second largest export market. But they could find markets elsewhere.
Chi viene poi alla fine penalizzato è quel consumatore.
Who really loses out is the American consumer. The cost of their Italian pasta would skyrocket, or possibly, Bazzana says, they simply wouldn't be able to find it in shops anymore. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Some people spend their retirement playing golf. Others travel. In Philadelphia, the retirees and the senior environment corps see themselves as watchdogs for the local environment. WHYY's Sophia Schmidt reports.
Bob Meyer is 71 years old. He retired from a career as a biology professor, but he still likes to keep busy.
The horrible lure of retirement is to do nothing. And, you know, that's no good because you just end up vegetating at home watching, you know, daytime TV, and I don't want to do that.
Instead, Meyer volunteers with the Senior Environment Corps in Northwest Philadelphia. The group of more than a dozen retirees take on projects like sampling the soil and testing the area's waterways for pollution. Today, Meyer is in a lab at a local college. He's looking through a microscope, counting tiny pieces of plastic, or microplastics, from a sample of creek water.
Okay, I got a pretty sharp view now.
He finds tiny pieces with jagged edges and thin plastic fibers.
Ah, got a thread, and it's pink, so I know it's plastic.
Altogether, Meyer finds dozens of pieces of microplastics in this one small sample of creek water.
I don't know how you get it out. I know how you stop it. You stop using plastic. But that's... we'll be pushing up the daisies before that stops.
It's not all counting plastics in the lab. Some volunteers wade into streams to collect water samples. Others teach kids how to identify aquatic critters. Meyer and fellow volunteer David Schogel say the group is always looking for new members to join.
Anything you're particularly looking for in people who join?
If they're breathing, we want them.
Schogel is 85 and a retired social worker. He sees the nearly three decades he's volunteered with the Senior Environment Corps as part of his legacy.
I'm not a wealthy fellow, and I don't have any money to leave behind to any groups or even my family. But I can leave a better world.
The group meets monthly at a senior center. That's where 74-year-old Eleanor Lundy Wade found out about it. She's a former health inspector and public health educator.
I said, there are seniors that love and do the environment. I said, I want to be one of them.
Fred Lewis helped found the group more than 30 years ago. At 98, he's the oldest member. He says the Corps has been testing water quality for years, but looking for microplastics is new. Lewis is old enough to remember back when plastic first became widely used.
I mean, it was something that was so new that people were just trying to get suggestions as how we can take advantage of it. And now it's how we can end it.
Lewis says some people might assume that the older you get, the less involved with society you become. But he hopes this group changes some minds.
At the count of three.
At the end of every meeting, the volunteers close by singing the Senior Environment Corps song. For NPR News, I'm Sophia Schmidt in Philadelphia.
We are tracking down pollution, and we wish we could do more. We are proud to bear the title of Senior Environment Corps.
Yay! That was a good rendition.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. We'll also hear some music and hear the set list from Malachi Coons, some live music you can check out this weekend. Coming up at 7 o'clock, DJ Lake Poseidon, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support comes from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. And we thank Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Wi-Fi to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. A chilly night tonight with lows near 10 below, wind chills down to 21 below zero. Partly cloudy, west-northwest winds 5 to 10. Increasing clouds tomorrow, 30% chance of snow. Temperatures 16 to 21, winds from the south 5 to 15. Greater chance for snow in the evening, lows near 7. For Friday, mostly cloudy, highs in the low 20s and a slight chance of snow in the afternoon. There is a sensory-friendly Santa event December 4th through the 6th at Northland Arboretum in Baxter. You do need to register ahead of time for a 15-minute time slot, and you can learn more and register at northlandarb.org. Click on Events. The United Way of Bemidji area has a VIP and Me dance this Saturday, 4 to 7 at the Loft in Bemidji. Kids and their caregivers can enjoy ornament making, games, and snacks in addition to dancing. Proceeds will benefit the Radiothon to End Child Abuse. You can let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. More news is next.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. NATO foreign ministers met in Brussels just a day after the last round of U.S.-led peace talks took place in Moscow. There is no evident progress toward ending Russia's full-scale war on Ukraine. Terry Schultz reports that European leaders in both NATO and the European Union are redoubling efforts to provide military backup for both Kyiv and themselves.
Many foreign ministers arriving at NATO headquarters expressed gratitude to President Trump for trying to end the war. Secretary General Mark Rutte went even further.
There is only one person in the whole world who was able to break the deadlock when it comes to the war in Ukraine, and that is the American President Donald J. Trump.
Rutte says he and his team have been kept well informed about the proceedings, but no European representative has been present at the talks. Former Lithuanian Foreign Minister Gabrielius Landsbergis finds that alarming and worse.
It is dangerous and it's humiliating because of what is being discussed is European security.
Landsbergis would like to see Europe stop hoping for an invitation to be by the U.S.'s side.
Instead of Europe begging for a place at the table, Europe should set its own table with a very clear proposals, what Europe is going to do to help Ukraine, what measures are going to be used to do that, and what Europe is going to do to help Ukraine win the war.
Estonia's Foreign Minister Margus Sakna echoed those thoughts in Brussels.
We must actually decide what we are going to do in Europe. Putin cannot decide over us. And as well, US cannot make decisions instead of us.
One big decision Europe's debating is whether to use frozen Russian funds to help Ukraine. Across town from the NATO meeting, the European Commission proposed using about $100 billion worth of these immobilized assets as collateral for a loan to Kyiv, which would be paid back if and when Russia pays reparations for its destruction of Ukraine. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen laid out the legal and moral arguments.
And we can equip them with the means to defend themselves and to lead peace negotiations from a position of strength. And since pressure is the only language the Kremlin responds to, we can also dial it up. We have to increase the costs of war for Putin's aggression, and today's proposal gives us the means to do this.
Many European governments think this is a brilliant idea, a game changer in the struggle to finance Ukraine. But there's one key holdout from the country holding most of the assets. Belgian Foreign Minister Maxime Prévost says the Commission proposal does not adequately share the financial responsibility for what happens should Russia sue and win the right to get the money back.
It is not acceptable to use the money and leave us alone facing the risks. We demand that the risks Belgium is facing as a result of this scheme are fully covered.
Von der Leyen says she believes the new proposal will address all of Belgium's concerns. She hopes to have a deal in hand in 2 weeks when European Union heads of state and government hold their last summit of the year. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Even though the federal government shutdown ended more than 2 weeks ago, some federal employees are still recovering from its effects. They told KNAU reporter Adrian Scabaland about it at a special dinner for them hosted by an organization outside of Grand Canyon National Park.
Ashley Dickerson has worked at Grand Canyon National Park for 3 years. The federal government shutdown had impacts beyond just getting furloughed for 43 days and missing a couple of paychecks, affecting nearly every facet of her life.
The impacts of stress on your mental health, on your physical health, like on your relationships with family and friends as they're checking in and trying to figure out, are you going to be moving back home in a month? Because, you know, have they fired you yet? And I'm like, I don't know what's going on.
Dickerson is at Plaza Bonita Restaurant in Tucson. It sits just south of the main entrance into the park. She and a couple of dozen other federal workers are enjoying a free meal of fried chicken and tamales, chips and salsa.
This is one way for us to show our support when the community has really been suffering.
Elizabeth Silks is the CEO of Grand Canyon Conservancy. It's the nonprofit partner of the park and is hosting a series of 12 free dinners for residents of Tucson and Grand Canyon Village. Many, but not all, are park employees.
We actually had 250 people at the last dinner, and what it tells us is that people didn't feel very valued who work in the park and the park communities, and a lot of this year has felt very personal.
First came the Trump administration's mass layoffs last spring. Then the shutdown meant about 9,200 National Park Service employees were furloughed. That's according to a Park Service estimate. It's unclear how many of the 500 people who work at Grand Canyon missed paychecks. Plaza Bonita manager Javier Rosas says it's nice to see locals back.
Normally here with us, Thursday was a local day that all locals inside the park used to come with us. And now with this shutdown, there's no more Thursday. So we saw a big difference with that.
Elijah and Wyatt Gibson, who are in 8th and 6th grades respectively, sit in a booth with their mom. Their dad is on the park's trail crew and was furloughed.
He's been spending a lot of days not going to work, and money's been a little tight.
Yeah, the big problem has just mostly been the money, and we've been having a lot of troubles with it.
Their mother, Cassidy Gibson, says even as her husband receives back pay, their family hasn't come out unscathed.
We were able to tap into some savings, but we had to use our credit card more than we'd like. Definitely more than we'd like. So it was hard. You know, that's our livelihood.
For other Grand Canyon workers, the shutdown complicated already stressful situations. Kim Acker, who's worked for the Interior Department for 14 years, had an unexpected medical emergency days after the shutdown began.
I essentially ended up with a large blood clot in my brain. You know, I'm looking at tens of thousands of dollars in medical bills, and it really made me think, can I afford to be missing paychecks if I'm going to have these bills that are due?
Acker says it's left her unsure of her future and whether federal employment is reliable. And she's concerned another shutdown could be looming. The budget resolution only lasts until the end of January.
In another month or two, are we going to be without paychecks again? And to be literally told that we don't matter and that we're not important and that we're low productivity. I mean, why would I want to work for something like that?
Acker says the Grand Canyon Conservancy's events have helped her and others feel more valued, but it still doesn't fully relieve her anxiety about what the future holds. The Conservancy is planning 6 more dinners like this for federal employees and people who live in Tucson and Grand Canyon Village this month. For NPR News, I'm Adrian Scabland in Tucson, Arizona.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay, in theaters December 12th. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options, at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's just before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you for your support. Coming up next, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective, then DJ Lake Poseidon at 7 o'clock for On the River, a great mix of music. Support comes from Boreal Brushworks Painting in Bemidji, providing full-service interior painting in residential and commercial locations.